Okay, welcome everyone to another episode of Spotlight. Today's guest is the FTP Theater Manager, host of the Hydrogen Jukebox, and co-host of The End Zone, better known to all as Calvin. Doing the interview today will be Steve Pellet. Our two recorders are Becky and Dennis. Thanks to all four of you for your helping making this a great success. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Steve to conduct the interview. It's all yours, Steve.
Thank you very much, Michael, and hi, everybody. Welcome to another Spotlight. And today the light is really bright, and it's shining on Calvin. And thanks for agreeing to be interviewed, Calvin. And I know you've got a lot of interesting things to tell our guests. But as always, I'm going to start by asking you to tell us where you were born.
Hello, everybody. Appreciate y'all having me. I was born in a small town, about 10,000 people, Clanton, Alabama. It's about 50 miles south of Birmingham and a couple hundred miles west of Atlanta.
Okay, that's placed it nicely for us. Well, for the people over there, we'll have a bit better idea now. Mum and Dad, what did your parents do? What did your dad do for occupation?
My mom's been in the computer consulting business for a while now. She was a secretary a while back, different administration jobs like that. Dad's done all kinds of stuff. He's been in construction, truck driver, refrigerator repair, jack of all trades. So that's pretty much the blue-collar environment I grew up in. Grandparents, same way. A lot of hard-working people.
Okay, any brothers and sisters, or are you the only one?
Nope, just me. My mom remarried when I was 12, so I've got a stepbrother and a stepsister from that marriage. But up until that point, it was a little old spoiled right in me.
Okay, can you just give us a brief feeling for what you remember when you were a kid? Did you go around the neighborhood playing with all the other kids? Just tell us a little bit about what you remember as a small boy growing up.
Yeah, well, for people that don't know, I was sighted until about 3 years ago, so as a kid, obviously I could see. I had quite a few friends there. We hung out. My real name is Shay, so having that name led to some interesting conversations in the playground. Teach you how to fight pretty quick there. But yeah, it was a good place to grow up, man. I know every generation talks about the generations coming up behind them as being totally ruined and society's on the edge of collapse because of them, but I'm going to join that chorus. I think my generation and the generation beneath me got some serious social problems. And growing up in the environment these kids are growing up in today has a lot to do with that. But yeah, I mean, where I grew up, when I grew up, I think it was a good time and place to be.
So it was like a pretty laid-back, pretty easygoing small community that you grew up in. Am I getting the right idea?
Yeah, absolutely. People knew each other pretty well in the community, for better or for worse. Your business was the place's business for the most part, it seems like. But also on the good side of that, you know, you had people you could turn to when you needed help, and family was always real close by. So, from the people I've talked to, it was a typical small southern community.
Tell me about your schooling. I suppose you started when you were about five, like most people do. I think school age for starting is about the same as it is over here. Tell us about your early days at school. What do you remember?
Yeah, I hated school from the first grade on. I couldn't stand the structure of it, or the fact that you know, everybody has to appeal to the lowest common denominator in public school, and that's the way it was then and still is now, from my understanding. I started when I was six, first grade. I had elementary, first grade through fourth here. I stayed in the same school system all the way through until I went to college. So first through 12th grade, I was in a pretty small size Alabama school system. And there were some standout teachers that helped me a lot. For instance, when I was in high school, I had a calculus teacher that really inspired me to show me that there's other things out there to do other than just basic English and science and stuff. Doing and knowing and understanding calculus and physics, I don't know, I think it was a great thing, and a lot of kids don't get exposed to that anymore. They feel it's too hard for a lot of kids, and take an exceptional child to learn calculus or physics, and I totally disagree. I think knowing those advanced sciences and math is, even if you don't use it as a job, it's a great exercise for the mind, especially when it comes to troubleshooting.
So, rightly or wrongly, the impression I'm getting from what you're saying is that you didn't really like school. Were you a bit, would you describe yourself as a bit of a rebel at school, but at the same time you excelled at the sciences? Is that a pretty fair way to sum up your attitude to your schooling?
Yeah, I mean, I was just really bored, and like, for instance, in 11th grade I failed Spanish but aced physics. I don't know, it was a stupid thing, you know. I think any kid that's not mildly retarded in public school these days could make all A's with some effort, but that was my problem. I didn't put any effort into it. And in fact, in my junior year of high school, I skipped as many days as possible. I was just at the limit of being kicked out. So by the time I got to be a senior, I turned that around and did real well on the ACT and SAT and all that, and fortunately pulled it out and was able to get into college. So I went on to Auburn University from there, which is a college here in Alabama.
Yeah, fine. When we were talking the other day, you did tell me that when you were about 11 years old, you suddenly discovered that you got quite a serious illness.
Yeah, actually, I'd been feeling real bad for several weeks, and this is when I was 11, and I've been real thirsty and urinating a lot and just feeling weak. And one day I was laying on the couch watching television. My mom was in the living room with me, and a commercial came on, and it gave the symptoms of diabetes. It said, are you feeling weak, fatigued? Are you drinking a lot, really thirsty? Are you urinating a lot? And I was sitting there, and I told my mom, I said, that's me, I got diabetes. And she was like, no, you don't. Anyway, went to the doctor, I think the next week, and sure enough, that's what it was, type 1 diabetes. I was put on insulin the next week, and now been on it for 21 years.
So that's the more serious form of diabetes, the type that you have to have treated with insulin injection. Did you have to self-inject from the beginning, or did people have to inject you on a daily basis for a start?
Yeah, I did it from the beginning. I remember they let us practice on oranges, giving the oranges injections, and I think they were really afraid that I wasn't going to be able to do it for myself, but I kind of thought it was cool, you know. I could stick a needle on myself in front of my friends and stuff and gross them out, so I thought that was pretty cool. And for about 18 years thereafter, I did 2 to 4 injections a day until I found the insulin pump. And for all you diabetics out there, and anybody that knows a diabetic, I can't recommend the insulin pump enough. It really helps regulate your blood sugar, because instead of taking shots where you might take one in the morning and then your blood sugar will go down and then it'll start to go back up and you take another shot and it comes back down, and throughout the day, the roller coasters, with the insulin pump, it gives you a little bit every few minutes, as your pancreas does. It's helped me tremendously, and it's a lot easier overall than taking shots, even for the blind.
That's interesting. Can you tell us a little bit how it works? Do you have to have this permanently, plumbed in, for want of a better word? You know, you say if it's giving you a little bit every few minutes, that suggests that you're constantly carrying the thing around with you.
Yeah, it's about the size of a pager, and it's got a 2 foot long, very small hose on it, tube that goes into an injection site. You change out the injection site about every 5 or 6 days. An injection site thing is it's about the size of 2 stacks of nickels, about 2 millimeters thick, probably about 8 millimeters in diameter. What you do each few days is you change the site around so you can put it in the buttocks. I like saying buttocks. In your stomach. I know some people do it on their side. I don't do that. Anyway, yeah, she's got this little plunger thing that puts it in you. It's not as painful as a single insulin needle, and you only have to do it about once every 5 or 6 days. It stays there. You can take that off at any point. If you need to take a bath or go swimming or whatever you want to do, it's real easy. I hesitated getting one for a long time because I thought it was going to change my lifestyle and be a real, real big pain, but it's quite the opposite. It's a lot handier, it's a lot easier, and it's also cheaper. You don't use as many supplies.
Okay, that's fascinating because I've no idea how it worked. It sounds a great advance, far better than sticking a needle in yourself a few times a day, I should think. You said that you were only 11 when this actually happened. How did your friends react? I know you said you thought it was cool sticking a needle into yourself in front of your friends, but how did they react? Did they change their attitude towards you in any way?
No, not really. I think the attitude got changed a bit later because I became a bit of a bookworm and I was into science fiction and computers and all that stuff. And because of that, I think the band of friends grew smaller and tighter. The friends I made in middle school, I still have to this day. I got 3 very close friends and kind of the 4 musketeers, if you will. But no, as far as the diabetes, other than stunting my growth a bit, I don't think it had too much effect. I was big into football and sports and that sort of thing, and at the time I was of average size, but as my adolescence went on, and I wasn't taking very good care of myself, I wasn't eating properly or checking my blood sugar like I should have. I'm a few inches shorter than probably I would have been otherwise. I'm about 5'7", and should be probably about 5'10". I got larger hands and feet and head. I should have probably, but no, I don't think socially being diabetic had a lot to do with things. Having the name of Che had more to do than that. My father named me after Che Guevara when I was born, so that was some interesting explaining to do throughout school.
Yeah, I hope it's not hitting a sensitive spot, but you seem very, very sensitive about that. It's always plagued you, obviously, and that's why we're calling you Calvin. And I know you as Calvin far better. But it's obviously rankled with you through your life. Is that a fair comment?
No, not really. I view it as a positive and not a negative, for sure. The reason I use Calvin, and the only place I use that is online, is I just feel more comfortable having just a bit of insulation between me and the. Some of the stranger elements of the internet community, so that's why I use Calvin on here. And no, I've never had a problem with having the name of Shay. At first it was interesting having to explain it and that sort of thing, but as I got into the computer graphics industry, it actually became quite a help because it's so unique and easy to remember for folks. So yeah, I definitely wouldn't have it any other way.
Okay, that's cleared that one up, because I did get the impression that it bothered you, but if you see it as an advantage, that's fine, absolutely great. Just let's investigate explore your diabetes just a little bit more before we leave it. So after you started your treatment, I take it that you started to feel better very, very quickly. and then things were back on the straight and narrow, so to speak.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, kids are very resilient, and it didn't, as I remember, it really didn't affect things that much. Probably should have more than it did. Like I say, I wasn't doing things properly. I wasn't, eating sugar-controlled meals. I wasn't checking my blood sugar the way I should have. So it didn't have much impact, although probably should have had more.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll come back to that a little later in your life story, because it did play a major part. But we'll come back to that a little later. So around about, you're about 11, 12 by this time, and I think you told me that it was around about this time that you developed your interest in computer graphics. I think you said you've always been interested since you were a very young teenager. How did that interest start?
Oh, well, as with so many other people I met in the computer graphics and animation fields, started with Star Wars. It came out when I was 6, so I was the perfect age to catch it. I don't know how many times I saw it, but it was a lot. And I just wanted to be able to enter that universe at whatever capacity I could. And then when the personal computer market started, around 81, when it started getting big anyway, I was right there with it. First computer was an Atari 800, if you want to call that a computer. It had a keyboard. I remember they were talking about 64K of memory. It was on the box, sort of their marketing thing. It said 64K, what are you going to do with all that memory? So what I did was I got these magazines that had games in them, and I typed in those games, and you save it to these 5 1/4 inch actually, discs. I'm sure a lot of people here are familiar with those. And so that's how I learned how to type. I was just always fascinated with computers and the things you could do with them. The fact that they're so black and white, there's no gray area with the computers. Things are either zeros or they're ones. And at whatever level you want to take it, that's the way it is. If there's a mistake, it's a human mistake. If you don't do things properly, things aren't going to work properly. And I don't know. I've always been interested in black and white environments like that.
Yeah, so that's the beginning of your fascination with computers, which of course led on to big developments later on. But just let's remain at school for a little while, and I'll ask you, had you got any ideas of what you wanted to do for a career as you came to the time for leaving school? Had you got any preformed plans?
Well, at the time, having a career in computer graphics was very rare, and I certainly didn't know anything about it. My counselors didn't know anything about it, even though I've been dabbling in computer graphics since I was about 12, 13 years old. In 85, I got one of the first Amiga 1000s. My family helped me buy it, and started learning and teaching myself some graphics programs there, which is a much higher level than the stuff I had done before. And I just did it because I was interested. I had no idea that I could make money doing it. So out of high school, I go into college, and I start majoring in computer science to be a programmer, which I did pretty well at, learning C and assembly and all the basic stuff there. But I came to realize pretty quickly that I did not want to do that for a living. I could not see myself going through millions of lines of code over the next few decades, just sitting there looking at line after line of code and having to debug it. I wanted to do something more creative than that. So once again, I lost interest in school, and things didn't go very well from there.
Yeah, so you just basically got sick of the boredom and the repetitiveness of what you were doing. I can see that. I suppose it's something you either take to or you can't stand. So you obviously decided it wasn't for you. So what was your next move when you'd made your mind up you didn't want to do that?
Well, this whole time I had still been doing the computer graphic stuff, and had always been a huge movie fan, and I was very fascinated by the way they did their special effects, which right now, you know, entering college was, that was 1990, so I was at Auburn from 90 through 93, and this was just the beginning of being able to do computer graphics for film and television, you know, for high-level effects. So I started looking into that, and I dropped out of college and started working at a boat seat factory back in Clanton, my hometown, while I decided what I was going to do next. I'm very glad I did that job because it really shows you what the average working person has to go through every day, have to put up with every day. It was not a good environment. It was a dangerous environment for the workers. And beyond that, these people are just mistreated. You know, they're making minimum wage. They're out there busting their hump every day and getting no appreciation at all for it. If I'm ever fortunate enough to have children, I definitely want them to have a job like that so they can appreciate what comes later. Anyhow, obviously I got tired of that scene pretty quick, and I opened up a company called Video Reflections. When I say a company, it was just me, you know, a company of one. And to get the loan for the equipment I needed, I started making wedding videos I think it was like $12,000 loan, something like that. Started doing wedding videos, but what I really wanted the money for was to get an advanced computer system that had this new 3D graphics software on it, so that I could teach myself the 3D stuff, which is just coming into maturity there on the personal computer level. So anyways, I'm doing wedding videos and making a little bit of money, enough to stay afloat, and teaching myself the graphics. About a year after starting that, I talked to this company in Birmingham called Bosda Studios, and they did a lot of production around the southeast for car commercials and stuff like that. So I started selling them some of my graphics for their commercials and doing it on my own system, which was great. I thought I was King Booger of the booger pile there for a while. Then I found out they were about to get a very advanced system in for their graphics department, called an SGI, which stands for Silicon Graphics Industries. Those at the time, and even today, are very, very expensive systems aimed exclusively at doing graphics. Very, very powerful Unix-based boxes. So I found out they were going to get that, so soon thereafter, there was an opening in their dub department where they make copies of videotapes, sort of the proverbial mailroom entry-level position. So I took that job because I knew they were going to be getting that system, and I could learn it at night while I did dubs during the daytime, which is exactly what I ended up doing. I'd work about 8 hours during the day making copies and then stay till 2 or 3 in the morning learning the new system. So that by the time they really had the system up and going and integrated into their network, I just went from being the dub guy to the graphics guy, and did all their 3D graphics from there on.
You said a few minutes back that you actually taught yourself because it was in its infancy. How did you go about teaching yourself such a complex thing as computer graphics? Were there manuals that you could use, or was it, did you just feel that you'd got a flair for it? How did you go about teaching yourself?
Well, I mean, there were manuals for the software, and technically I absorbed all that stuff. Then, you know, like learning anything else or becoming proficient at it's all about obsession and experience. I sincerely believe that you can't be good at anything you're not obsessed with, and for a long, long time I was very, very obsessed with computer graphics. It was a universe that you could really lose yourself in. You could create anything you wanted. For those of you out there that never had the chance to see what you can do with a computer as far as visual art goes, it is incredible. You can make anything visually, and you can make it look as real as you're willing to put time into. It is, you know, really incredible what can be done with it, I think. But yeah, I taught myself on my home system, that package, and then when SGI stuff came in, I taught myself that too, because there were folks that, you know, weren't necessarily interested in me learning that. You know, there are other people that wanted to do the graphics. So I was totally on my own there and had to make it only based on what I was able to do. I had no degree in it, you know, I had no real experience at it either. So it was all a matter of, can you do this job? Well, okay, if you can do that, can you do this? So there, in about 6 months or so, I was able to start producing all their graphics as far as the 3D side of things went.
Okay, that's fine. I think you told me that you've worked for several companies. You moved on, didn't you? I think, where did you go after that? Because I know you've worked for several organizations. You did a little bit of moving around, didn't you?
Yeah, I started with the 3D graphics and then started dabbling in compositing, which is where you take separate elements, like for a film, for instance, you might have a shot of a car running into a bridge abutment or something, and then you have a separate shot of an explosion where somebody's lit off a gas fire in a 55-gallon barrel or something. You can take those two elements and put them together and make it look like the car exploded. That's the stuff that really fascinated me on the computer side of things. So I started learning that stuff. So I started learning that while I was in Birmingham at VOSDA. Worked there a little over a year. I got an offer from a company in Richmond, Virginia, making significantly more money. And they were going to get a system that allowed compositing. So I took that job. Worked there for about a year. By the time I finished there, I'd gotten fairly good at the compositing side of things. So I had a pretty good tool, because I could do 3D stuff and compositing by the time I left Virginia. And at the time, that was pretty rare.
Mm. And then things really began to take off for you in a big way, because you then moved to Atlanta. And when you were working in Atlanta, something really spectacular happened to you, didn't it?
Yeah, I moved from Virginia to Atlanta in 96, and we had several companies we did stuff for, the Discovery Channel being one of those, and the Learning Channel being one of their channels. We started doing all their documentary work and stuff, and in 97 we did their package for the documentary series called Superstructures of the World. And that was my first experience as visual effects supervisor, which meant I had a team of people beneath me, and I was in charge of making sure, you know, they got stuff the way the client wanted it, and, you know, we got some cool looking stuff in there, and everybody was happy. It's basically my responsibility. Anyways, we got nominated for an Emmy for that in the documentary and news category. And I really didn't think we had a shot of winning. I mean, we were up against some very stiff competition, including The Living Planet. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that, but it's a really great series of documentaries. Anyhow, ended up winning an Emmy for Visual Effects Supervisor. So at that point, obviously, the amount of money I could ask for went way up. So went from Atlanta and moved to Los Angeles, where the real heavy hitters were.
That's brilliant. Absolutely fantastic. So you won the Emmy. Tell us how you heard about that. How were you told that you'd won?
Well, we got nominated. There's a board, you know, that determines whether or not you're in the list. There's five nominees that year. So once you're nominated, you're invited to the Emmys. So we flew up to New York for the actual Emmy ceremony, and we were probably about three-fourths of the way down the list, which meant you had to sit there and wait for a couple hours until you found out if you won or not. It was very nerve-wracking, because everybody knew what was at stake. You know, if you win, then your career's just set for the next 5 years. If not, then, you know, back to the grindstone. And it's a very rare opportunity. There's some talent involved, but a great deal of it's luck, a great deal of it's being in the right place at the right time with the right group of people. And I was working with a great bunch of folks. I mean, to this day, it's the best group of people I've worked with in a small group like that. We produce some amazing looking stuff. Just some really talented people getting started in their careers. So yeah, we're at the Emmys and they're calling out all the nominees, and they get to news and documentary and they call out our name, man, and up on the stage we went.
Yeah, and I bet that felt fantastic. And just imagine how thrilled you must have been to receive that, and you know, really, really well done. Just a little aside there, Calvin, what's an Emmy actually physically like? Because I've no idea.
It's about 18 inches tall, got a huge base around it. Base is the size of a small dinner plate. It's a statue of a woman. It's all gold, and she's got wings on her back, and she's holding up a big globe made of three intertwined rings. It's a very pretty looking award. I've gotten a few through my career, but that's definitely the standout. I don't have it here at my home because my mother has it, and I'll get it when I pry it out of her cold, dead hands one day.
Goodness me. So after that, you know, things really, really began to happen for you in a big way, and you went to work in Los Angeles. And what was that like, working in L.A.?
Well, people talk about what a weird and strange place L.A. is. I didn't find it to be so. I mean, there's, in my experience, weird and strange people everywhere. The transition from Atlanta to Los Angeles wasn't much of a transition at all, other than the beautiful weather out there. I would love to live where I lived, you know, the rest of my life, if there weren't so many people in L.A. It's just way overcrowded. I lived in West L.A., right near Santa Monica, so I was about 2 miles from the beach, and I was, because of that, able to ride my bicycle to the beach, and it was really nice as far as the location. The company I went to work for out there is Click3X L.A., real good bunch of folks, and the job I was doing at the time, like I said, was a compositor. I was the youngest person I knew doing that job, and the only one from the South out there that I ever met. And that produced its own set of challenges because, number one, being young, you know, you got these clients that are paying upwards of $1,000 an hour for your services. They don't want a young redneck, you know, running their million-dollar machines initially. So you have to overcome that. My southern accent didn't help at all initially with clients. So, you know, you have to show them what you can do. You got a demo reel, but people are going to be prejudiced despite that. I know one time I had these clients, and like I said, they're paying right at $1,100 an hour for my time. Not that that wasn't what I was making, that's what the company was making. Anyways, because of my youth and accent, they thought I was the coffee boy. So I come in to start the session with them, and they order, you know, two lattes, a cappuccino, what have you. So I went and got it for them. Okay, I'll make you coffee at $1,000 an hour, sure. So I get back and give them their coffee. I had just the way they liked it. They're like, thanks. You know, about 15 minutes had gone by at this point, and they're like, do you know where our compositor is? I said, I sure do, because I am him. I sat down and started working, and, you know, they just freaked out, you know, embarrassed that they treated me that way, embarrassed that they made the judgment I made, but ended up, they turned out to be some of my favorite clients. We got along fabulously after that, and we refunded them their coffee time.
Oh, that's a great story. I can just imagine that. You get the same sort of thing over here, you know, where certain parts of the UK, people do make assumptions, and it's just the same. So that's good on you. Good on you for beating them at their own game. And of course, LA's famous for movie making. And did you get into that? And if so, did you work on any famous movies?
Yeah, there near the end, I started getting into the movie stuff a lot more, which is what I had gone out there to do in the first place. The first movie I worked on was a pretty small thing. And then we went on... Oh, let me back up a little bit. When I first went out there, I was assigned to the TV show, The X-Files. So we did a lot of their graphics there for a while, which was a great experience, and got me used to working with some of the producers out there and their way of doing things, which was a big help before you go into the movie side of stuff. So the first movie assignment I got was the movie adaptation of Kurt Vonnegut's Breakfast of Champions, starring Bruce Willis. And I thought I was on cloud nine getting to work with this film footage of Bruce Willis and, you know, straighten that stuff up and get some effects in there. And I remember the first big effect I worked on was a shot of this guy going, he had to walk into a mirror. I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with Kurt Vonnegut, but tends to be some rather hallucinogenic stuff in there, and the movie represented that. The movie didn't do very well, unfortunately, but I loved working on it. Working on film stuff's a lot different than working on television, other than the egos involved, because television, on average, you're looking at about a meg to a meg 0.2 per frame on a television digital image, and you got 30 of those frames per second, so you're looking at about 35 megs a second, right? When you're working on film, you're looking at about 100, 120, maybe 150 megs per frame at 24 frames per second, and you have to be much more exact because of the greater resolution, and plus people are going to be looking at this in a theater, you know, on a huge 60-foot plus screen. You got to get it just right. So a lot more exacting science, and a lot more exacting art too, for that matter. Anyways, after Breakfast of Champion, there are a few more movies. Stigmata, worked on that, kind of a horror cult movie thing, starring David Byrne. The Green Mile, Stephen King's, a movie based on Stephen King's series of novels there. That was my favorite. It's a really good movie beyond the special effects we worked on. The Grinch, did some stuff on that with Jim Carrey. The big deal there with The Grinch was Jim Carrey, to look like The Grinch, he had to wear this awful set of makeup that took like 4 hours every day to get on him. So he had to get up at like 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, get all this stuff put on. And then to get the look of the eyes, which are yellow and really veiny, he had to wear these semisphere contacts, which means they're wrapped halfway around his eyeball, and they were extremely painful, so much so that they ended up bringing in a Navy SEAL torture expert to help him deal with the pain, you know, to meditate, to breathe, to take his mind off of it. Anyhow, he finally just couldn't take it anymore, and that's where Digital Domain came in, which was the company I was freelancing with at the time. And they go in and do some replacement on the eyes, where the 3D guys will make computer contacts, if you will, and then the compositing guys will go in and place those contacts over his eyes, frame by frame by frame. You go in, you get them in place, make sure they track properly, and you go in and paint the eyelashes back in, get the lighting just right, all this stuff. It's very meticulous work. You're looking at tens of thousands of man hours just for the contact work there for his eyes. But it's amazing. I mean, just to sit there and look at those huge frames come in on your computer monitor, and being able to work on Jim Carrey's face, and a project directed by Ron Howard, who I got to meet and talk to. It's just a killer over the rainbow experience for me.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, again, you're going to have to forgive me here, Calvin, because I've never seen, and probably there's quite a few people in the room that have never actually had vision. So what we're saying is that with your software, you can manipulate images and create effects and stuff to create anything, basically, that you, that the producer or the filmmaker wants to create. So you're manipulating his eyes to look as if they have the effect that they wanted in the movie. Now, do you have to do this process for every frame, so to speak? I mean, or can you just, well, you know, to use an analogy, cut and paste, and it all go on to the images which follow sequentially, or do you have to painstakingly do every one?
Well, I'll give you a quick breakdown of the Grinch stuff, for instance. We would get the 3D guys to make us a three-dimensional set of eyeballs on the computer. Then they would take the frames that were given them of Jim Carrey. Let's say we have one shot that's 3 seconds long of Jim Carrey looking down at his dog in The Grinch. What you would get, the 3D guys would take and track their three-dimensional eyeballs to where Carrey's face was. And then if he looks down at the dog and tips his head over, those eyeballs would be tracked. Once that was done, you got Jim Carrey in one series of images. So we're talking 72 frames, right? For 3 seconds. They do that for 72 frames. Then the compositing guys would come in, take the 3D eyeballs, and composite them over Jim Carrey's real eyeballs, which would involve putting back eyelashes, which that you did have to do frame by frame, making sure the lighting was right. You know, you had to color tint it just right to match what they shot showing Jim Carrey's face, and basically detail work to make sure you've got film grain on it so there's a little in the grate, that sort of stuff. A 72 frame shot, in this case 3 seconds of film footage, could take several days of work to get done properly.
Now I'm beginning to understand why it costs such a colossal amount to make a film, you know, because you hear of a film and it's cost X million dollars or X million pounds to make. I'm beginning to understand now why that is, because obviously it's painstaking work and very, very skilled work, and it's beginning to make a bit of sense. I mean, you don't realise what these actors and so on go through. You said he had to have painkillers to help him cope before he came up with this technique, and you know, the things they put themselves through to make a movie is absolutely incredible. Have you got any other examples of your favourite effects that you've worked on? That obviously is one of them, but any others?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing to me that video footage is still allowed in the court of law, because given enough time and money, the group of artists out there could make it look like you did anything. We did a McDonald's commercial once with Scottie Pippen, and the premise of the commercial was this kid had posters of Pippen in his room, and he brings some McDonald's french fries in, puts them on his desk, and the poster comes alive, and Scottie Pippen jumps out of the poster and gets the fries, you know. We had a shot of Pippen looking down, and we had another shot of Pippen smiling, but we did not have a shot of Pippen looking down and smiling. So it fell upon me to integrate those two elements. So I took the shot of him smiling, and frame by frame took the part of his face from the bottom of his nose to his neck and integrated that into the shot of him looking down. Took about 4 days to do that, but once it was done, you couldn't tell that Pippen had ever not look down and smile at the same time. Now that's a fairly simple example, but in the movie The Gladiator, for instance, which I did not work on, one of the co-actors there died before they finished shooting film, and they still had 2 scenes with him that they needed. So they simply took previous shots of his face that they had and composited that over the shot of a body double, and you can't tell. I mean, I dare anyone to look at that film and tell me which shots, you know, the guy was alive for, which ones you weren't. That kind of ability and technical skills, pretty scary.
Yeah, you say the camera never lies, but of course you've just shown to us that it can. It is incredible what you can do with visual, and I suppose audio as well, but the visual must be fascinating to manipulate things and make them happen even though they haven't actually happened. Can you describe the working environment? I mean, were you actually anywhere near where the film was being made? I'm trying to get a feel for how they did it. Did they complete a film and then give it to you guys to work on, to do your work, your magic, or are you working alongside as the actual movie's being made?
Usually not. Usually you get the film and you start working on it, but as a visual effects supervisor, you have to be on set to direct what goes down so that you get the proper elements you need. And quite often you're working against what's called a green screen, and what happens there is, let's say you're doing a shot for Peter Pan and you need Twinkle Bell flying around, right? What you would do is you would shoot your actor in front of a large green screen, and it's a hideous color of green. It's very bright, but the reason being, the computer will look at all that green, and anywhere it finds that particular shade of green, it will remove it and allow you to place Twinkle Bell over whatever background you want. So if you shoot an actor, it looks like they're flying through space, and then you bring up a background of some helicopter footage over a city flying through there, you composite the two together, and boom, you've got Twinkle Bell flying over your city.
Fantastic. So you were working on the sets. Did you have the chance to meet any of the stars of these movies? I mean, you know, were you rubbing shoulders on a day-to-day basis, or did they keep you well away from the action, from the actual stars?
No, I never met any big stars, on-screen stars. Usually the stuff I was doing was of a more technical nature, making sure their setups are right, that sort of thing. I did get to work with some great directors, though. Ron Howard on The Grinch. Oliver Stone, who directed JFK, Talk Radio, Platoon. Got to work with him, although that was on a television commercial for Motorola, which was to air in China, actually. He never wanted to do any commercials for an American audience. He felt it was maybe beneath him, or he didn't want to dilute his presence here, but he directed a beautiful commercial for Motorola talking about their wireless services. Not to go into too much detail, but it was a really cool concept. It showed all these different items being used without wire. You had a kid playing with a yo-yo with no wire in it, a trolley car going through the streets with no wires, clothes being hung up and showing no wires, so we had to go in there and remove all the wires and stuff. It was pretty cool. But working with those guys was just amazing. I mean, to meet Oliver Stone, who's one of my heroes, not because of any kind of special effects he ever did, but because I'm a huge movie fan, it pretty much blew me away. I worked with him for about a week there, and he kept calling me Alabama Boy. I'm not sure he ever learned my real name, but that was fine with me.
Yeah, so you were doing all this great, great creative work and really on a high, and then things started to go a little bit wrong for you, didn't they? At this point, in the middle of this, you began to have problems with your sight.
Yeah, like I said earlier, to be good at anything, you have to be obsessed, and I was completely, absolutely obsessed with what I was doing. I'm sure I was averaging over 90 hours a week, and sometimes upwards of 120 hours a week working, which contributed to the eye strain and lack of circulation in the retina. Started developing diabetic retinopathy, and in June of 2001, I got my first big leakage where the veins in the retina, which because of the poor circulation were weak, leaked blood. So I woke up one morning and I had this large black spot in my vision, my right eye. So So I go to the doctor, and excuse me, he tells me about the whole retinopathy thing. We do some laser treatment. Doesn't help, gets worse, keeps getting worse. In August, I took a job offer in Atlanta at a place called Artifact because I wanted to be back closer to my family. Started working there at the end of August 2001. Vision's getting worse. I'm going through all these surgeries and, you know, getting the air bubble put in my eye. You have to keep your face down. A great friend of mine, David Douglas, was with me at the time. He was able to drive me to work and back and help me with the smaller details of the graphics work. He was trying to get into graphics himself. My hat's off to him for the amount of help he gave me. I never would have been able to start that job if it hadn't been for him. Have a couple of eye surgeries there, actually four between July and December. By October, my vision had gotten so bad that they had to fire me. They just couldn't afford to pay me the amount of money I was asking, especially the amount I had slowed down, you know, because of my vision. The final surgery I had was in December of 2001, and I pretty much finished off my vision because I had to keep my eyes under such pressure while they did the surgery that it totally collapsed what little circulation I had left. So by the end of December, I was completely blind except for a little bit of light perception in my right eye, which is where I am now.
Wow, so from the time you started to develop the problem to the time that you were practically totally blind, what sort of time span was that?
Almost exactly 6 months. They had never seen anyone lose their vision that fast due to diabetic retinopathy. And I contribute that to a great deal to staring intently at computer monitors the way I did for so many years. Obviously, the main culprit is the diabetes and lack of control therein. I don't blame anybody but me for the blindness. You know, if I had taken better care of myself, I'd probably still have fine vision. But it's one of those things, you don't see it coming, so you don't know how to get out of the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, there you were, a young guy, because you're only a young guy now. And you'd had all this success, and it seems ludicrous to say you were using your eyes for employment, because, of course, all sighted people use their eyes for employment and to function. But your eyesight was very, very important to you. You know, it was your whole world, wasn't it? Your creativity, your all that creative energy and all that creative spark was suddenly taken away because you lost your sight so rapidly. How on earth did you cope? Can you remember what you felt like when your vision deteriorated to the point that you couldn't see anything?
Yeah, I mean, I've just taken the attitude from day one that, you know, things can always be much, much worse. I mean, you don't have to look far to find someone who you don't, well, I should say, who you'd rather not be, who you'd rather not have to go through what they have to go through. And, you know, still got my health. I still walk around. I got somebody with me I love very much. I got a great family. I guess, you know, you got to focus on the good things. Anybody can say things are awful and, you know, how can I go on and all this, but I think everybody has a positive side of things they can look at and say, you know, things aren't that bad. And two, I think I looked at it and saw that I had made the most of the time I had when I could see. You know, I did what I wanted. I can't imagine I could have gone any farther, any faster than I did. And I guess, as far as all that goes, I have no regrets. It was a lot of fun. Made a lot of money, met a lot of great people, had a lot of incredible experiences, you know. Living in L.A., man, you can surf in the morning and snowboard that night. And I did those things. You know, I firmly believe that it's much better to regret the things you did do than the things you didn't. And I don't know. either I'm very self-delusional or I truly believe that.
Well, I commend you for your attitude, because you know, some people would have just given in altogether. Maybe I don't know what some people would have done. You know, probably end it all. But you obviously decided to handle it, and I commend you for doing it in the way you have. It must have been a terrible experience. Were you offered any counselling of any description, or did you just basically say, "No, I'm going to handle this on my own"?
Yeah, when I got back to Alabama, I lived with my family, or my parents there for a while after I came back, you know, while I was getting used to being blind. And, you know, they wanted to give me counseling and all the rehab stuff, and I just never found it necessary. You know, I never felt like shooting myself or any of those despondent things. One thing I'd like to say about that, I've got a grandmother who has raised a son with Down syndrome. She had him rather late in life. He was born with Down syndrome. And they told her when he was born he probably wouldn't live to be 5 years old. Last 2 weeks ago he celebrated his 48th birthday. And I look at people like that, like my grandmother, who were able to persevere, you know, just get through it and do it with a good attitude, and I don't know, to sit around feeling sorry for yourself just doesn't accomplish anything.
Yeah, there's an expression we've got over here, I suppose you've got it, there's always someone worse than yourself. We've got that expression, and I think that pretty well sums up it, you know, very, very well.
Yeah, you know, I felt sorry for myself for having no shoes until I saw a man with no feet. And that may be a little cliche, but by God, it's true.
Absolutely, yeah. So you obviously handled that side quite well, well, very, very well. I don't suppose you were going to let computers go out of your life altogether. So how long was it after losing your sight that you decided to investigate the possibilities of using a computer again with assistive technology?
I started to look into it while I could still see some. And believe it or not, I didn't run across JAWS or Window Eyes until probably January of 2002, after I'd gone completely blind. I can't remember the name of the product now, but the first thing I looked at was a hardware-software combination that how did that thing work? It had some kind of motor in it, and as you moved your mouse around on the screen, it would, I guess, vibrate or move or something, let you know you'd clicked on an icon, and I guess it would read the icon to you or something. Anyway, at first I thought that was the thing blind people used, so I was looking into that. It was exorbitantly expensive, but then soon thereafter, I think my mom ran across JAWS, and I got a demo of it, and started using that, and I got that, and then started hacking around the internet a little bit, and found a site, Accessible Chat. Started talking to people on there, and then can't remember exactly the path that led me to for other people. That's been great, man. Every blind person I run across, whether on the internet or in person, I tell them to come here. It's a life-changing place, I believe. It's definitely changed mine for the better.
Yeah, we'll come on to that in a second, Calvin. But I'm just fascinated to know, with all your computer knowledge prior to you losing your sight, how did you take to just using the keyboard rather than a mouse? Did you find it difficult? I mean, was it easy for you to learn to use the keyboard rather than click, click, click all the time with a mouse?
Yeah, because doing what I did, I was always a big proponent of the keyboard, and having the computer science background and programming, you know, I'd use it a great deal and type pretty well, and no, it wasn't too bad. Although I have to tell you, I think the mouse is still a viable option for the blind. It just hasn't been implemented properly. I've given a lot of thought to doing games for the blind using the mouse for a aiming, driving, whatever you want to call it. Just because it hasn't been done before doesn't mean it wouldn't be a great option. You know, there's games out there for the blind right now where you use the arrow keys to aim and shoot. Well, you could do the same thing with a mouse with audio clues as to where you were aiming and that sort of thing. So, but anyway, I digress. I think the thing with the keyboard, yeah, it came pretty easily. Although I can see how it would be very difficult for a person who lost their sight and didn't know how to touch type to get into using computers. And I find it very sad when I run across blind folks that don't use their computer or don't even have a computer because they're scared of it. I can't hardly imagine not having a computer at this point. You know, I spend 80% of my time at it. I'm doing different things from the radio shows to writing to music and et cetera, et cetera. If I could help a few people that wouldn't otherwise use a computer use it, that'd be great. There was one man at the guide dog school I went to who had no idea about JAWS and the internet and all that, and I showed him some things, and I think, you know, it looked like he was going to at least look into doing it. So if I can get one person to this universe of ours, that'd be great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You said a few minutes back that for the people it plays an important part in your life now. And I think something very, very, very special happened to you because of your involvement with For the People. Would you just like to tell us about that?
Yes, I lost my virginity on For the People. It was great. No, the thing I found on here, one of the greatest things of my life, sitting right here giggling. Tenderfoot, you guys know where Tenderfoot, Teresa Newton. Yeah, that, we met on here. How long was it? About 3 or 4 weeks ago? When was that, babe? Huh?
Last August.
August of 2003. She's a fantastic human being. One of the greatest people I've ever met, and beyond being my girlfriend and lover. That alone, you know, worth everything else. It's a beautiful thing to wake up next to her every day.
That's great. I'm really, really pleased that you've found each other on the Peeps. That's fantastic. And long may it continue. Okay, can we just investigate a little bit about your other interests away from the computer and so on? What else do you like to do?
I like eating. Eating's good. I've dabbled at the guitar. I still suck at it. Getting there, but practicing is hard. I'm working on a book right now. I find that to be more interesting and more of a creative draw. Once again, you're creating your own universe, so as I said before, it's a black and white situation. If it fails, it's your fault. If it succeeds, it's your abilities that made that so. It's much more difficult to write being blind than when I could see, just from an editing standpoint. You know, you go back and get the flow right and make sure your sentence structure works and all the dialogue flow in, that sort of stuff. So, but I know it can be done. Polo, who you interviewed on here, has written a book. I highly recommend you guys support that. I can only hint at the amount of difficulty it takes for a blind person to write a book, and I have the utmost respect for him for having been able to do that and pretty much publish and release it on his own, from my understanding, with just a little bit of narration help.
Yeah, I spoke to him about it, and he's done really well. I Have you got ambition to publish this book, or is it just purely for your own amusement? Have you got plans to have it published?
Yeah, I think every author hopes to get his stuff out to a wider audience. But most of them writing this for me and some close friends and family, you know. So I think keeping it along that vein will be a more honest book. It's fiction, and it's funny in a dark humor kind of way. We'll see. I don't know. It's definitely a great learning experience, no matter what happens with it. By the way, Polo's book's called The Secrets That We Keep, and I think that's the website too, secretsthatwekeep.com, if you want to check it out.
Yeah, you're quite right. Secretsthatwekeep.com is indeed where you'll find it. You're involved with the FTP Theatre recently, where you put on DVDs and films. How was that your baby? Was that your idea because of your interest in films? Or how did that come about?
No, I think it was kind of a natural outgrowth of FTP Radio, which was Barry's brainchild. One more brilliant gemstone in his crown. For you folks that may not have tuned into FTP Radio, please check that out. It's pretty amazing to me that all us amateur DJs can put on such high quality stuff. And, you know, every show is just, I don't know, I find it just amazing at the quality and the breadth of music you can find out there. And, yeah, it's really entertaining. I think Hallie's got a show coming up this afternoon. I want to say 3 Eastern. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong. Hallie's Honky Tonk Heaven, so check that out if you haven't yet. But yeah, FTP Theater, let's see, we got talking about it and having a venue for doing movies and documentaries and that sort of stuff. And this is kind of unrelated to FTP Radio, which is music. Barry was kind enough to give us a separate IP and room for that. So we show movies every Saturday night at 7 p.m. Eastern, as described. In fact, tonight's movie is Monsters Incorporated, the Pixar animated movie. Ironically enough, it's all computer animated, but don't let that throw you. It's really well written, really, really cute movie, and suitable for all ages, as they say.
Okay. Maybe a difficult one for you, just as we come into the end of our chat now. What are your hopes for the future? Where would you like to see yourself in 5-10 years' time?
I'd like to be the ruler of Mars, the very small population that peels me grapes and toasts my ice for me. But I don't think that's realistic. I'd like to have a house in Clanton, which is the city I grew up in, and be near my family and babysit kids in the family, maybe have 1 or 6 of my own, depending on how many I'm talking to Teresa into. Obviously being married to Teresa in the very near future. I'd be satisfied with that, you know, and able to do my little creative things, work on a book, learn some music. I think, you know, if you're not learning, you're not growing. And as long as I can learn stuff, I'm pretty happy camper.
Yeah, I wish you all the very best with that. It sounds, I know you're going to achieve it. I know you're going to do all those things in the future. Out of all the things that you've done so far, what would you say is your greatest achievement?
Well, I know it sounds soap operish and cliche and mamby-pamby, but finding Teresa and, you know, finding somebody to click with and somebody put up with me and laugh with me, that's pretty incredible, I think. I think it's very rare for people. And, that's definitely my greatest achievement. In the professional world, the greatest achievement would have just been being able to do what I did at the age that I did it, and show some people in California that, you know, Southerners are just as viable. as anybody. That was always a pleasure of mine, was to get in there and kick some butt for some people that didn't think it could be done.
Well done. Okay, I'm going to throw these at you now. I just want you to give me the first thing that comes into your head. No thinking time. Just have a bit of fun at the end. Your favorite game?
Doom.
Okay, your favorite film? It's going to be hard for you.
Raging Bull, 1980, Martin Scorsese. In fact, I'm working on the described version of that for everybody.
Favorite actor?
Robert De Niro. Philip Seymour Hoffman's a close second, though.
And your famous actress, favorite actress even.
Well, for different reasons than most people do, Margot Kidder, because of the way she totally burned out. Found her behind a bush a few years ago.
Favorite drink, alcoholic or non-alcoholic, whichever takes your fancy?
Non-alcoholic would be a Coke with some peanuts in it out of a bottle, which you can't get anymore. An alcoholic, good old Miller Lite.
And your favorite fast food restaurant?
Carl's Jr. in Los Angeles. Man, that place got the best hamburgers in the universe.
You never know, I might get to try one day. Thanks, Kelvin, that's fantastic. Thanks for very much indeed for the interview. That's the end of my bit. I'm sure if one or two people have got anything to ask you, you'd be willing to just answer a few questions or take any comments from the room. But thanks very much indeed. It's been really, really fascinating learning about you. And congratulations. You've had a great life so far.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it, man. And I'm sure everybody appreciates the time and effort you put in to this every week. Same for Michael. The volunteers at this place that makes it work. So thank y'all.
Okay, anybody got any questions for our Kelvin?
Yeah, I've got one. Kelvin, I can't quite visualize this diabetic pump that you have. You said that you had a plunger that you had to put into a different site. Is there any part of the pump that's kind of like internal, that's actually sewn inside? And how did they put this pump in?
No, it's all... basically what you've got is a ring. Think of it as a donut, if you will. About the size of a nickel, a little bit larger. In the middle of that donut is a needle, right? And that donut with the adhesive holds the needle in place so that the insulin can go through the needle into the fat tissue of your body, if that makes sense. And you just replace that site every 5 or 6 days in my case. And then the pump, you set it to give you a certain amount every few minutes. And then, like when you eat a meal, or this is the great thing about it, you can eat whatever you want as long as you take as much insulin as is required to balance it out. So, like, if you want to eat a cake, which ain't healthy for anybody, but if you wanted to eat a cake, you might take 30 units of insulin. You know, no sweat, you can just dial it up and away you go.
Can I tell you, anybody else any questions?
Sorry, just another comment is kind of like, Calvin, the FTP Theater site, it's one of the major reasons why I've come here, why I'm at for the people, and I really hold it close to my heart, so I just want to say thanks for having that site on, because I can come to the site and watch a movie every week, but I don't understand anything, and they're modern movies, they're not from like the 50s or the 60s, usually. So that's great, and I just want to say thank you. And I just want to ask you, where did you get your movies from? Like Happy Gilmore and It's a Wonderful Life and stuff like that. Where did you get your movies from, your described movies?
Well, WGBH makes about 80-90% of the described movies out there for folks, and you can check them out. I think it's WGBH.org or something like that. You can get their movies on videotape. And I'm hoping to do more and more described stuff myself. Recently we did The Empire Strikes Back. It takes about, that was an action movie. That one took about 25 hours of audio recording and editing to get it done. But I'm hoping to do more serious fare. I mean, for a career I did effects movies, but those aren't the kind of movies I like to watch. I prefer something more bite to it, more dramatic movies. like I say, Raging Bull is my most favorite movie, and it doesn't have a single special effect in it. So, yeah, if anybody has suggestions for movies they'd like to see, or a movie they'd like to see described that hasn't been described, you can email me from the homepage there. Get a link under the DJs.
Yeah, I don't see an address for that, but I have a suggestion. You said The Green Mile was a movie that you did. That's one of my favorites. Can you work on getting that described? Would that be possible?
Yeah, it seems like I saw either an upcoming announcement that WGBH is going to do that one or something. Yeah, I'll look into it. That is a great movie. It's a great book, too. But yeah, they did a really good job on that movie. Now, I can tell you this. Next week, we're going to be showing The Shawshank Redemption described, which is the same director as The Green Mile, also written by Stephen King, also set in a jail. So there you go.
Yeah, can you just interrupt for one second? Just anybody has any questions because of our recorders, but you know, you're quite welcome to carry on talking about the films. But anybody else got a question?
I don't have a question, but if it's appropriate, I just want to thank Calvin for giving us a real sense of who he is. And I'm going to be 82 my next birthday, and I want to thank him for two philosophical outlooks. I like that expression, you can't get out of the way of something you know that you don't know is coming, and it's better to regret the things you've done than the things you haven't done. I want to thank him for those two things.
Hey, my pleasure, man. That's what we're all here for, to help each other grow, I think.
Calvin, excellent interview. Great job, Steve, as usual. Really enjoyable.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. That was good. Thanks, Cal. That was smashing. I enjoyed that.
Hey, I appreciate it, guys. I appreciate y'all tuning in. And like I say, check out the FTP radio. There's something on every single day. If there's no more questions, I'm going to jump out of here and stick myself in front of the TV and watch some college football.
Okay, Calvin, we'll let you go. Thanks a million. Well, I'm going to go as well. Thanks for coming, people, and catch you on the next occasion.